Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 115, featuring Jeff White from Industrial Light and Magic, visual effects supervisor there. And he just finished supervising Kong Skull Island, which we all went to go see just moments before I recorded the podcast. Is that right?
We had a little research mission, didn't we?
It was like last ditch. Like, did you have much notice, or did you just like...
Well, no. So what happened, it was interesting. ILM got in touch with me saying that, Jeff White would love to be on the podcast because he just did Skull Island and the movie's coming out. So it's perfect time to do it. So I thought it was great. I actually went to San Francisco because I was doing another podcast, which will come out later with Johan. And then I met Jeff there. I did the Polaroid picture with him so I could get the Polaroid, but then I didn't have time to do the podcast with him as well. So we did this over Skype right after I saw that. So it's actually one of my first and rare Skype podcasts, which was a little bit tougher, but I still think it worked out pretty well. But what did you think of Skull Island, Melissa?
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't all about Tom Hiddleston.
No, it wasn't. It was for you.
You wanted to just
sadly.
Watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. It was good fun. It was action-packed, as you'd expect, but kind of some funny moments in there too. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun. It was interesting to talk to Jeff about it because obviously we find out a lot about his history and background, but there was a lot of snippets of information that were really interesting, like the fact that Kong was so big. You know, I've done a lot of character work that he was so big that you can't light him like a character. You kind of have to light him like a landscape for you to get the
Monkey
sense of
Mountain.
Scale. Yeah. Yeah, he was huge.
Well, and he's used to doing all the Transformers stuff. So he's done stuff that's big.
He's done big things.
But not
true.
Furry big things.
And I think Kong is bigger than most of the big things out there. So I think, you know, that he's done. But has obviously been involved in a lot of that character work at ILM. And we talk a lot, actually, because I was curious about Lemony Snicket, because that was a kind of an interesting thing to me, the early movie, because of the baby. But that's a whole other thing. But
baby, yes. Yeah, the one with the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My favorite part of when I was a tour guide at Universal, by the way, was the King Kong experience.
Oh, yeah?
That was my only break.
Okay.
You're in the soundstage, and it's like air conditioned, and it's in the valley. It's ridiculous in the summer. And so that was my moment to like... And breathe.
No. Wow. Yeah. Well, that's cool. I mean, I love King Kong as a general character. I think he's very engaging, you know, sort of a tragic, misunderstood behemoth, right?
And, yeah. A lot of kind
like
of horror
me in
stories
grade.
Are like that, right?
Yeah.
You in eighth grade.
That was me in eighth grade. misunderstood.
Oh, and we should tell viewers to sit through the end of the credits.
Right.
No spoilers, but... Stay.
For Avengers King Kong.
Stay through the credits. It's very good.
Where does Stan Lee show up in Kong Island?
It's not a Marvel film.
I know.
But it was really, I don't know. It was awesome. I love the fact that it took place in the Vietnam or right after Vietnam War. And then it's like.
The music was good.
The music was good. And it just, you know, it has that Apocalypse Now kind of feeling to it. And it was great. It was a lot of fun. And as you said, it had some nice funny moments too.
Yeah. Go see it.
Go see it. A lot of fun. Okay. We have a few announcements to make. The first thing is V-Ray 3.5 for Maya will be coming out very, very soon after this podcast goes out. So, or soon. Let's just say soon.
Soon.
But a lot of people are waiting for it, and they want to know when it's coming out, and just letting you guys know that it's coming out very soon.
It's in the batter circle.
Yeah, exactly. It's warming up.
Yeah.
And then some events that we're going to go to. Melissa, on April 27th, you will be at AIA, right?
Yeah, in Orlando.
In Orlando.
Get to go to Florida.
Yep. AIA is the big conference for the American Institute of Architects, which is a huge conference. And we will be there. We have a booth there, is that correct?
Yes, we have a booth.
And we are going to be showing things like V-Ray for Rhino and SketchUp. And Revit and all those things. So catch up with us there for anyone who's interested in that technology.
Catch up for some SketchUp.
There you go.
Catch up.
I should do marketing.
You should do catch up for some SketchUp. Aren't you kind of sort of doing marketing?
Yeah, maybe.
You're a wordsmith,
aren't allegedly.
You?
Allegedly.
Everything I do is allegedly.
Yeah. All right. So other event is FMX.
Yeah,
right?
That's early May.
Early May, I think like May 2nd or something.
2nd to 5th.
Right.
Yes.
And so that's going to be happening.
I'm not going, but you are.
I am going. I will be going there, and I'll be doing some things over there. So
that's in Stuttgart.
That's in Stuttgart. I've been there 3 times now, and I love it. It's great. I love FMX. It's a lot of fun. Yep. And I'll be probably podcasting there and doing a few things. Vlado will also be there. He will be a speaker there. And he will be talking about...
V-Ray.
Well, V-Ray, yes. Well, he'll be talking about
the
sort
history.
Of the history and sort of the lessons learned about V-Ray, because I think the series of talks is sort of centered around the people that had won some technical achievement awards in
the SciTech,
the SciTech awards from the Oscars. So, or sorry, from the Academy Awards.
That's right.
And so that's going to be a lot of fun to hear that and put it in context with the history of rendering and ray tracing. And I'm also going to be doing a live podcast, right?
Not live podcast recording.
Recording.
Can you say that? That sort of
it's a live audience.
Yes.
It's a live audience.
They alive.
Yeah. And so please come and join us, because I'd love to get some audience participation and find out
anyone
questions.
Anyone listening who's going to be there should
There'll be a Q&A, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
That's on the 3rd. May 3rd.
And then we're going to have other talks on the 3rd as well, right?
Yes, yeah. We've got Unit Image and Debati Studio there and Scanline VFX.
So that's great.
Some very cool presentations.
Lots of cool stuff. So definitely come by for V-Ray Days and see some of the awesome talks that are happening. And I think that's about... Oh, we have a booth there too, right?
Yes.
Okay. And swag.
And swag.
Mad swag.
May or may not have t-shirts.
Okay.
We will.
We have buttons.
We'll have something that you can put on your body, though.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. All right. Something will be there. Anyway, we're looking forward to seeing you guys at AIA and FMX. And let us know what you're going to want to see when you're there, so we can help get all that stuff ready for you. All right. Hopefully you guys will enjoy this great podcast with Jeff White. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I have to admit that I just left the theater about an hour ago from seeing Kong.
Oh, good. Excellent. That's very fresh.
Very fresh in my mind. We decided that obviously since we were going to take a small office outing to grab lunch and see Kong just before the podcast, that way it was going to be really fresh.
Excellent.
What a fun film. Oh, my gosh. That was so much fun.
It's good. It is. It's a very it's a very enjoyable film. You know, it's like I had the same feeling when I just got to see it again after kind of a 2 month break, and coming back to it, it's a really fun film. It's kind of it feels like exactly what I want, you know, for a big monster film, where it's just, you know, great visual spectacle, you know, these nice scenes in between that kind of progress the characters, and a lot more humor than I originally realized going into the project.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, it was really great. I mean, obviously the characters were just really, really cool. And obviously also setting it up for a big sequel. And because we are visual effects people, we did stay through the end of the credits, and I should tell people to do the same thing, because there is something that shows up at the end that's going to, you know, get you excited for the next one. So,
well, I'm glad you were there, because even going to the premiere, about half the people missed the end credit scene.
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I know. It was like, oh, everybody sit down. You're going to want to catch this, because it's a really nice interlude into what's coming next.
Yeah, and do we know when that's coming out?
I don't know exactly. That's a good question. Adzilla itself, I'm not exactly sure. Maybe 2018?
Okay, all right. I'm sure something IMDb will probably let me know something.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's really cool. So what I'd like to do is sort of introduce people a little bit about your background. A lot of people sort of get interested in finding out how people end up in the positions they're in and what they do and how they got there. And obviously, I've been looking at your bio that's on the ILM site, and there's a lot of great information in there. But why don't you tell people a little bit about where where, how you got started in this, and I know you went to SCAD for a while, and then after that you sort of moved on to Leica. So where did your interest in visual effects sort of begin?
I actually started off, I went to Ithaca College, and if you know Ithaca, it's a very small town in upstate New York.
Oh, I went to
where
to,
I grew up.
I went to Colgate University, so it's not that far from there.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot going on there, film industry-wise, mm-hmm. although kind of a very rich tradition in computer graphics, other school there, and it has a great film program, and actually a lot of people have gone through there. I went to the film program there coming out of high school. I just wasn't sure really where to get into visual effects. I always loved computer graphics work in films. I mean, I was there opening night, not just for Jurassic Park, but The Lawnmower Man, and basically anything I could find that had visual effects and or animation. And that includes just like really enjoying the reboot CG cartoon. On Saturday mornings, to me, that stuff was all very pioneering.
Right.
And the work that I did, and I really wanted to get into it, and from upstate New York, it's it seems very far away. So I went to Ithaca College and I studied film there. But a friend of mine, Ben Watson, and I worked there, had both really interested in computer graphics. And so through our process and through the film school, my senior film making that first animated film, and at the time, we were working in Lightwave, and we both worked for the Academic Computing at Ithaca College, and could essentially, they were, worked day there kind of supporting the computers, and then at night turned them into our, and the only time it went bad was if we would sort of oversleep and forget to shut down the rendering in the morning when everybody was trying to actually use the machines.
Right.
That was really kind of my intro into computer animation and, trying to get a project done. And from there, I graduated and went to Savannah College of Art and Design. And there I studied computer art in their graduate program. And I was there for about a year and a half. And when I got at Vinton Studios. At that time, it was called Will Vinton Studios, and it's now Leica.
Okay.
And that was incredibly exciting. And they were actually, at that time, Wave to Maya, and I had studied both, and really loved Lightwave, but also studied a lot of Maya in graduate school. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of hired on to help out with them making that transition.
Okay.
And it was great. I mean, I loved living in Portland. It's a fantastic city. And at that time, they were still working on two stop motion animated television shows called The PJs and Gary and Mike. So while we were working there, doing mostly commercial work at that time, they still had a lot of stop motion animation going on, which was fantastic. And just to be able to kind of walk around the stages and see all of that in progress, I really loved that aspect of working there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had actually left there before they had switched over to Leica.
Mm-hmm.
It was at, I think, in San Antonio, where I interviewed with ILM, and it's very intimidating, there's incredible smart people around the table that you're interviewing with.
Yeah, so this
and,
is what's been around
commercials. You're kind of.
This must have been around 2002,
oh,
right?
Ahead. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. There's in commercials. One thing I love about it is that you're on a new project every 4 weeks, and you kind of get to dabble in everything. And so when I interviewed at ILM, they said, well, do you want to be a lighting TD or a character TD? And, I was thinking, well, I'd done, quite a bit of lighting at Vinton Studios. And they said, well, we're really just hiring character TDs right now. Lighting TDs would be later. I said, character TD sounds great. And that's kind of how I got my start at ILM, just working in the character group. Which I actually am very grateful for. I think, the films that I've been able to work on, and particularly, worked on as an effects supervisor, I've really sort of gravitated towards creature films or films with a lot of character work. And I think having that background in rigging and simulation and all the things that our character group does here has been extremely beneficial.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's pretty awesome. I know I saw some of the stuff you've done, and I kind of wanted to ask you a couple of questions. I know I saw that you worked on Lemony Snicket. And mm-hmm. did you work on the baby in that one as well?
The baby and snakes, you know, the little snakes that wrap around the arms, kind of the smaller creatures in that film.
Yeah, because that baby was unbelievable. I think it was one of the first areas where I started to realize that people can do digital humans better than we expected. And I think it's one of the first ones that did that.
Yeah, it's.
And Benjamin Buttons is another one, obviously with a bigger example, but it was a lot more prominent. But mm-hmm. the baby on Lemony Snicket was absolutely incredible. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the challenges you had on that?
The baby, actually, it's one of those films, you know, I mean, if you look back, it's in very few shots, but boy, it felt, you know, in many ways kind of way ahead of its time. It really still holds up. There's a particular a spindle in his mouth and then turned towards camera. There was a pretty big team involved in that one, and you know, at the time I was just working on like small pieces of simulation, and it was really, you know, a lot of the clothing and stuff like that that was in progress there. But it was quite a challenge, I think, to get all the different components, and particularly the performance piece and the skin rendering at that time, I think, was quite advanced for us as far as what our skin shaders were able to do. So it's quite a while ago, you know, as far as the details of the work that we were into, but certainly I think one of those great examples of something that's kind of in a small movie that passed by but really is a spectacular effect.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly why I wanted to bring it up, because I think it was so important and so well done. I know that Christoph Harry was involved in some of the skin shader stuff that went on mm-hmm. in that thing. And I think that it was just a really well done piece and something that should be noted as being important, in especially when it comes to digital humans. So that's why I was excited to hear about it.
Yep. No, I mean, my piece on that was largely, you know, just helping with some of the skirt simulations and or the baby's dress, and then, you know, rigging up the snakes that kind of wrapped around their arms. So I don't know a whole lot of the details of like some of the skin shading parts of it that enjoying learning about, but not that heavily invested in the TD lighting side of things. Yeah.
Okay. Now, they also mentioned the fact that you were working on a special type of rigging system called Block Party. Can you talk a little bit about what Block Party mm-hmm. is?
Sure. Kind of, let's see, I guess really used in production on was The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. It was a project that a friend of mine, Jason Smith, who's also a VFX superhero, and I had started. And it was really based around the fact that we wanted to improve the efficiency of rigging and to also be able to get to the point where we could do muscle simulation and skin simulation on the kind of production timelines that we had. And at that time, we actually had quite a bit more time, you know, for rigging than you get nowadays. But still, the goal was kind of the same. Like, how can we make the process of rigging more efficient, more reusable? Because you know, a lot of the approach to rigging tends to be lay out, you know, a series of locators, you know, have a rig draw off of that, and you know, everybody's rigging has gotten much more sophisticated since then. But at that time, there weren't a lot of great tools for compartmentalizing rigs and being able to reuse them. So we developed a system where it really had two major components. One was that each of the rigs could be encapsulated into a block, and those blocks had plugs and sockets between each other. So you could you could have an arm, you could have a hand, you could have a chest, how to plug into each other. But if you wanted to change, let's say, one type of rigged arm out for like a cartoon stretchy IK arm, it was just a matter of being able to change that block out. And it would still be able to all the underlying code would know how to draw. And that gave us a lot of power just in terms of you know, on a show like Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, where we had a lot of fantasy creatures, where you might have a centaur horse body and a human, you know, torso, it allowed us to essentially bring in, you know, our human kit and get rid of the legs, bring in the horse kit, and then say, okay, now plug the spine, you know, into the end of the horse neck. And I think what also made it very powerful, and it's kind of one of the central ideas of it, is that all of that rigging is encapsulated in a geometric volume. So rather than having where all of the locators are, the character 2D or even the modeler would start off by just taking a volume, a mesh that has all of the sort of associated with vertices. You resculpt that mesh to fit your character, push the button, and it would not only draw the rig based on those locations, but also you could load in all the skin weighting that was on that mesh and transfer it to your new character. And in that way, you could get up and running, and it would certainly need, you know, cleanup and work from there, but you could get up and running, you know, with a character very quickly. And in the case of Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, we were able to sort of combine the different rigs, like a human torso, arms, neck, head, and it would pull in appropriate skin weighting from each of the blocks that it drew. Since the skin weighting wasn't just associated with mesh, it was also tied to which blocks are actually being created. And so I'd say that was kind of the two like biggest advancements with that. And it was definitely a labor of love for the two of us. It was also very hacky, and, you know, lived in our, you know, home directories for a long time, and then, you know, slowly it progressed and was developed upon to R&D took it over and essentially has now recreated as Block Party 2, which is used across, you know, all of our locations here at ILM, and still retain a lot of those same ideas that were developed in the original Block Party.
Well, that's a really cool tool. I kind of like the idea that it's like this kit of parts that you can assemble together. I almost imagine it being in like some kind of cabinet. It's like, I need a horse part and two rings, and let's put this thing together and see what happens.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and that was really the goal. It's like, you know, we're always working on all these fantasy creatures that are not standard bipeds, and how can we encapsulate rigging into these, you know, block-like components. But one of the hard parts about it initially was that, you know, a lot of rigging tends to be sort of custom little rigs that you connect up, and the way you set up constraints and all the relationships between the different parts. And so the system had to evolve, and it especially has evolved now that it's in its second iteration to allow a lot more of that customization.
Yeah, well, it's really cool. And obviously all of your knowledge that you've acquired on character work is now sort of translating over to what you did on a lot of your movies that you worked on after that. Obviously you worked on the Avengers, and you worked on several of the Transformer movies. Mm-hmm. And Warcraft obviously was the one you worked on just before. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's correct.
Okay, and then but Kong obviously is a big creature thing. It's a big, mm-hmm. There's a lot of creature work in there. So I can imagine that was definitely something that was right up your alley. How did that come about? Were you the overall visual effects supervisor on it?
I've worked with Steven Rosenbaum. Yeah. He was on through all of the principal location shooting, and then a little bit into post, and then I was working as the overall VFX soup for all of ILM's work, because we did the bulk of the work on the film, and then Tom Peitzman was the co-producer and VFX producer on the film, and he really managed the in-house team, which did about 300 shots on the movie.
Okay. Well, it was obviously a lot of work, and I'd like to sort of think about like how long did you guys work on it, and what were some of like the bigger challenges that you guys had in front of all of that?
Sure. Yeah, probably from my first meeting with Jordan, it was about 2 years end to end. And the, you know, it was very interesting because I was working with Scott Benza as the animation supervisor, and we had worked together many times on Transformers, and we both kind of came into the film and, you know, did what we usually do, which is start gathering up all the reference we could find of gorilla movement and gorilla behavior. And then we had some of our initial meetings with Jordan, and it, you know, he really wanted to take it in a very different direction. which I was pretty excited about. I mean, I loved the whole concept that where we're setting this monster film just after the Vietnam War and sort of all the visuals that come along with that. But he also wanted to make sure that this Kong felt very, very different than Peter Jackson's Kong in 2005. And, you know, that was incredibly well executed and just really, really fantastic work. So we specifically in almost every instance kind of tried to deviate away from that. And, you know, for Jordan, it was who's the director of the film. He wanted to kind of recapture a little bit of what was in the 1933 version, where this was really, you know, a movie monster. And it's a gorilla, but really, you know, when you look at its anatomy, it's kind of this gorilla-man hybrid. And it's got very extreme features, you know, kind of everything that you would sort of normally associate with gorilla has been pushed and, you know, stylized a little bit. And that even includes, like, the fur color, you know, from it being a black-haired gorilla into something with this more reddish-brown color. So I think at every step in the design process, we were trying to figure out, you know, how do we make this guy look unique and the god of the island and sort of establish this new Kong for this new series, you know, that Legendary is doing.
Yeah, it was really cool. And honestly, I had a very strong memory as a kid. I guess I was about 6 years old or so when I saw the Jeff Bridges 1976 mm-hmm. King Kong, and had very vivid yep. memories of it. And this movie had a lot more of that same feeling, because it's almost in the same time frame, except there it was present time and here we're going back in time. But the feeling was very similar of that era in the 70s that was surrounded by, you know, paranoia in some way, right? So
absolutely,
yeah. It was a really and Kong was fantastic, and he felt
central themes for Jordan.
Yeah, and the Kong felt really, really big. I think this was the biggest Kong I've ever felt, and it was really well executed in terms of feeling that size. And obviously, a big theme of the movie is the eyes. A lot of close-ups on eyes, both from the character and in the creatures, and. So tell me a little bit about the eyes and how you guys worked on that, because obviously that was incredibly well done.
Oh, thanks. I mean, it's certainly not unintentional that the film kind of opens and closes with Kong's eyes. You know, at the beginning of the film, you push right in to Marlowe's eye and you're kind of seeing Kong reflected in there. And then at the end of the film, we fly all the way into his pupil, which as we, you know, when we had that shot turned over, we weren't that far from the end of the film deadline. And, you know, just thankfully we'd sort of worked on Kong and, you know, modeled and painted Kong to a level where we just knew we could kind of put the camera anywhere.
Right.
But the eyes were such a big part of this Kong. You know, it was really the main way that we could communicate any sort of change of emotion. Because Kong doesn't talk, you're kind of left with, you know, facial cues and eye animation to kind of really sell some of these bigger moments for him. And, you know, as much as the movie he spends sort of smashing helicopters and, you know, crushing things and fighting other monsters, Jordan gave us these like great little quiet moments. One up on kind of a ridgeline with Weaver and Conrad, where he just lingers. You know, he kind of comes off of Weaver and she's touching his nose and sort of Jordan moves the camera up to Kong's eyes and just kind of lingers there while they're sort of searching around. And you know, we had learned a lot about making CGIs from Warcraft, actually, just with Duratan and trying to make sure that they felt alive and, you know, what all the different components were that we were looking for in terms of how the eyes were rendering with the right refraction and having the right bit of tear line in there. And, you know, with Kong, it was definitely a balance of, like, we didn't want him to look too weepy, but be this emotional moment between the two of them. Allison Farmer was our texture painter on Kong, and she just did an incredible amount of research on gorilla eyes. And one of the nice things about them is that They just have so much incredible texture in the sclera. You know, they're very rarely just plain white. They have, and the more they turn the eyes to the side, like both the outside and inside, it just reveals all this incredible, almost looks like a staining texture there. So she really went to town on the eyes, including going in and painting displacement maps for the iris, so that, you know, as we pushed in really close, the iris would shade in a way where you could feel just that subtle displacement that happens with all the tissue that's in there. So it was definitely a combination of, you know, a lot of great animation put into kind of communicating the emotion, and then a lot of time just spent on the technical details of how they shaded and looked.
I'm gonna talk about eyes a little bit with you, because this is something that's very interesting to me, and I want to know if you could name the top things that happen in eyes that make you think that they are alive. I think they're obviously very important towards the conveying emotions and what's going on, and obviously as much detail as you can get in as possible will help that. But what are some of the other things that you feel really sort of sell that feeling of it being a real eye that's alive?
So much of it comes from the movement. In fact, like, you can kind of get everything else sort of right, and if the movement is spot on, you kind of buy in. And it was something that we particularly found when we first started on Warcraft with Durotan, where we were doing facial capture with gaze tracking on Toby Kebbell's pupils. And in fact, Toby helped us out with some additional facial capture for Kong, where, you know, he would go through the scenes and kind of act out some of the emotional beats. And so we'd spent a lot of time looking at and matching to all the little sort of micro darts and small, you know, subtle animation that was in the eyes, in order to be able to communicate that emotion accurately. What we found that was so interesting, and this was actually back to our first Warcraft test, was that we applied the facial capture gray, but with realistic looking eyes, and you know, everybody was incredibly excited about the character already just from the eyes looking real. And I think, you know, again and again, when people are cue into the eyes right away, you know, it's certainly the window of the soul, like the old adage, and it's absolutely the place where we spend the most time, and that means that, you know, everything has to be right technically too. I mean, John Walker was our look dev TD on Kong, spent a tremendous amount of time taking, you know, our more human sized eyes that we had perfected and, you know, spent quite a bit of time on, and then now translating that to fairly large eyes that are on our 100-foot Kong,
right?
And making sure that you know, all the detail came through there. We look for you know, shading of the lids onto the eyes themselves to make sure you get that nice little shadow line. Certainly, getting the tear lines right is a big part of getting the eyes to feel correct. And then, you know, with a character like Kong, in many, many scenes, he just requires very special eye rigs. A lot of times, he's up in the sky where you don't have a lot of high contrast detail in the reflections on the eyes, so they tend to look too cloudy, which almost gives him kind of a cataract feel. So sometimes we would end up using sort of custom reflection map that you get that nice bright dark complexity in the eye reflections, and then certainly adding additional, you know, lights to give us those little pinpoints and additional highlights that make it feel natural. But we did try, and, you know, with Kong, not try and like overly studio light his eyes, just trying to think about, like, if this is a little more towards a nature documentary and we're just out there, but to really kind of integrate them into that environment, and the eyes were certainly a big part of that.
Yeah, I would think that basically the way that the lighting is going to be extremely important to convey scale, because as you said, if you do studio lighting for a person, obviously you would never be able to get a light that's as big as you would need for Kong in real life, and that would diminish his scale. So he has to feel sort of like part of a landscape in a sense, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think, you know, scale was by far our largest problem on this. And, you know, But, communicating that he's actually 100 feet tall in a natural environment where you don't have the typical scale cues that we usually do. You know, if Kong was in the city, well, then, you know, that's a 10-foot, you know, story. And, you know, he's like, you know, 100 stories tall, and you kind of immediately understand how big he is. What we spent most of our time, well, there were a couple of things that we did to try and address that. One was certainly the hair groom itself, two groomers on the on Kong, just because it took about a year, you know, end to end, to get Kong's groom. It was Gail Morand and Ryan Gillis, and they spent a tremendous amount of time just working on making sure the groom had all the sort of right direction changes and style changes that would happen over the space of, you know, 20 feet, which is his chest. It was actually very quick to get it to a realistic looking hair groom on Kong initially, but he just looked like a gorilla. That all the hair was very straight, it was all very uniform, and, you know, that ends up looking very CG. So we ended up actually kind of moving away from gorilla reference and looking a lot at camels and buffalo and all these other creatures that had just amazing changes in their groom, and just getting some really gnarly, you know, nasty looking hair, just as matted and gunky and twisted and wild, I guess, as we possibly could. And in that way, by seeing the changes in the styles of the hair groom, let's say down the length of the arm or down the chest, that really helped us, you know, kind of understand how big he is. And then we kind of pushed on some technology that we'd started really, I would say, on The Revenant, even a little bit on Warcraft, for putting stuff in the hair. So throughout the movie, he's always got leaves, sticks, you know, twigs, banana leaves, caked mud, and it would be dry mud, wet mud, whatever is kind of appropriate for the scene, just sprinkled all throughout his fur. Adding what we call these little sesame seeds, which were almost like little white dots onto his face that just helped break up and take away a little of the CG clean curse. And it was actually some of the, like, those little sesame seeds on the face were something we had an opportunity. They were doing some surgery on a gorilla down here at the San Francisco Zoo. And so the team went down and got to go in while the gorilla was under and just, you know, take amazing, incredible high-resolution photography, which was really valuable throughout the production process.
Really? How did that land on your lap? That's amazing.
It was all, you know, set up through production, and it was really like one of those you know, once in a lifetime opportunities. And what was interesting that they all sort of related when they came back was how the smell was, just how pungent and, you know, how strong the odor was. And we actually talked to the actors a lot about that when we were on set, because you can imagine, like, a 100-foot gorilla has got to smell awful. And so we sort of keyed on into that and said, okay, well, you know, he's probably going to have like a swarm of flies. And so they're pretty subtle, but if you look in the shots, like, there's usually like little black flying around Kong all the time. And, you know, they're probably huge flies at his scale. You know, it might even be the size of your hand, but we figured, well, it's Skull Island, you know, and anything can be giant sized. And we always put birds in the scenes and just tried to include as much of this sort of ecosystem of smaller creatures around Kong as we could, and again all really with the goal of trying to sell how big he is.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Obviously, there was a lot of secondary characters, and I want to sort of get into some of those as well. But one of the ones that that I really loved was I guess it's a water buffalo of some kind. I'm not sure what kind of animal that was, but yeah. It, with all its stuff hanging out, like, I mean, I guess you guys did something similar on Kong, but it had so much stuff growing on it that it was incredible. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about some of the stuff that you guys did for that character.
Yeah, that was actually a very difficult creature for us to create. it's that again, it was kind of a combination of several departments working on it. Jordan always had this idea that there should be these sort of wonder moments in the film where it's not something, I mean, most of the stuff on the island is trying to eat them. So he wanted to have a few scenes where there was just these creatures that would, that lived there and they could, but you know, they were still sort of spectacular in the same way that Kong is, and kind of larger than life. So the idea with the first water buffalo is that it's actually camouflaged, and you just think it's, you know, grassy mound out in the water, and then you know, it kind of comes, wakes up and comes out of the water. And it was a huge challenge because we were so close to it. The water buffalo itself is probably about the size of a helicopter, and we sort of used, I would say, our traditional creature pipeline for the hair and the horns, you know, all the skin detail, and the texture detail, especially around the eyes. And then our environments team, and this was Carlos Munoz, that was really kind of driving the development of grasses and vegetation in other shots for Kong to interact with. He actually put all the grass. So it's kind of using the pipeline that we developed separately for vegetation interaction. We just were able to kind of paint that in and get that same natural growth on its back. And then when the effects team was in there, and Florent Andor was our effects sim supervisor, he was doing all the water and actually came up with a setup in Houdini. Seaweed hanging off the horns. So really, it was kind of a multi-discipline, all hands on deck effort to get that creature looking real. But I do think all those details help you understand how big it is and make it feel like a living thing there. And then in particular, like just that one last little layer of having flies swarming around its head makes it feel like a more natural environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it had the right feeling of wetness and gunkness, and all of those things were really well integrated and put out. Obviously, the nose felt very moist and strong, and but the eyes were another part of that as well, and an important part of that creature that was the signal that this is a peaceful animal, right? Like the way those eyes looked did not look threatening, and that was really great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we really had to sort of resist the temptation to put like a, you know, a more classic, you know, eye in there and really stick to these kind of very dark eyes, which I think helps with the sort of mystery feel of the creature, and just ended up looking really fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about these bad guys though. What are they? What are the Skull Crushers? Is that what
the Skull Crawlers? Yeah. They went through so many different names.
Oh, really?
You know, while we were working on them.
Yeah, I bet. So now
they're not Skull Crawlers. So that's what we've gotten pretty used to. Yeah, they were actually in many ways just as much of a design challenge as Kong. The first part was, I guess, really kind of a animation thing. Jordan had come to it with, like, he had a design that was pretty much very similar to the small one that you see in the film, where it's this very graphic, easy to understand skull face with these dark orbs that represent these false eyes. And then it has a kind of a snake-like body with very human arms. So all of that is kind of a challenge on its own, just to figure out how do you make that thing like that exist in the natural world. But then Jordan also wanted this sense that when the skin is stretched tight over the spine and over the chest, that it actually takes on some translucency and you can see into it. And there was no hiding, you know, anywhere as far as the anatomical design of that creature. And it was a huge challenge for our rigging team just to get it to be able to all the things under the skin and the skin to simulate on top of that to get that to work.
Yeah, I can imagine, but that's you can't mess around. You've got to feel the skin rolling and moving with all the bones and actually see it happening for real. So you can't fake that. But I'm imagining because of the very strange design in terms of this creature, which was really unusual, that something like the block party thing must have helped in some way because it only has two arms to move with, which is kind of strange. I mean, obviously the rigging challenges of it making it absolutely correct was one, but was something like Block Party used for this to help sort of make that process work?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that includes now, I mean, Block Party has gotten much more advanced to where it also can help you load in all of your muscle tree. And we use the muscle geometry to help all those transition areas where skin weighting really just doesn't hold up. And I would say, you know, the shoulders have always been the most notoriously difficult areas. And on this particular creature, the shoulders have now been, they're just front and center all the time. Right. When you see the creature from the front, you kind of get the head and then the shoulders. So the setup that had to be put in place had to really hold up very well across all of these shots and to feel anatomically believable when the creature moved its arm forward. And one of the real challenges too is like it could stretch its arms down, which would rotate the deltoid kind of down towards the ground, but then it would also kind of sit its body low and swing the elbow out. So the worst case scenario of all the different poses that it could hit. One of the other big challenges I think that there was a lot of concern about was, do you understand this idea of the false eye and the real eye? Because the real eye is actually set back on the creature a little bit, and you know whether the audience like fully gets that or not. You know, I'm not entirely sure. I don't know if you noticed, you know, both of them. And at the end of the day, I think the sort of graphic nature of the character works regardless of where you think the eye is. And one of the fun things about it actually is the mouth, which looks horrific, is actually pulled pretty directly from some turtle reference that we had found.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So don't mess with turtles.
Okay.
The other big challenge we had with that creature was because in the script, it really was important that the audience could differentiate between the baby version, which is what they encounter in kind of the bone graveyard there, and then the mama version, which is the one that comes out of the lake. It was really important for that final battle that that it felt like there was this creature that could actually potentially win against Kong. And I think the animators had a lot of fun figuring out, you know, what kind of things could this creature with a snake body and two arms do that would be pretty unique. And for Jordan, I think it was also really important that these never feel like dinosaurs. He absolutely didn't want them to feel like velociraptors. He really wanted them to feel like their own unique species. And so the animators used a lot of the tail of especially the mama skull crawler to do these kind of cool judo-like moves to really transfer the weight and be able to throw Kong to the ground. And I thought some of that stuff was really fun and fantastic way of sort of thinking about how these two creatures might fight each other.
Yeah, that's a... It was a really, I'm not going to try to give too many spoilers, but it was a really pretty epic battle on it. And I think that people really enjoyed it. And I think you did it. I mean, you succeeded in exactly what you did. It's like, clearly this thing is bigger and fatter and meaner. And when you already know how big Kong is, and when you see the scale of this thing next to it, it's like, yep, this thing is way, way bigger and way meaner. One of the things I think I want to ask a little bit about is I didn't realize until just recently that the guy who plays Jack Chapman is actually – did he motion capture all of Kong as well?
Yeah. Toby Kebbell, who I knew from Warcraft, came in and we had a day with him to do facial capture. So Terry Notary, we did a lot of the body capture with. And then Toby Kebbell did a pass at facial performances for us. And a lot of that, I mean, I knew Toby just from him playing Durotan. Like, he really understands how to communicate a performance through these characters. And so I was really excited to get a chance to work with him again. And, you know, Terry, same thing, like just an incredible motion coach. And Terry is able – the great thing about having him set up and do motion capture – was that Jordan could iterate very quickly through different shot ideas. And, you know, so if you think about the way Kong pounds his chest, we did maybe 10 iterations of those. He'd do, you know, one fist, two fists, different cadences. All of that gave us a nice library and gave Jordan good material to choose from. I think in the end, you know, partially because the creative changed to a degree from when we'd done the capture to what Kong needed to do in the final sequences, and partially just translating any motion to a 100-foot tall character, definitely, you know, say that the animators had a significant portion of all the performances getting those kind of fully dialed in.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So you basically had two different actors doing it, and Toby was sort of mm-hmm. supplying most of the facial capture, or just some significant some.
I would say you certainly used it as inspiration, and again, because the nature of some what happened in some of the sequences changed, we weren't able to use it directly, but it certainly gave us a great library of reference to kind of work off of for some of the key beats. And in particular, one of the most challenging shots that we had to do on the film was the one where he's eating the squid after he's fought it. And you know, that for that one, Toby actually grabbed a pack of red vines and, you know, was chewing on them, and not only did it give us great reference for, you know, what the movement of the mouth and jaw should be through that action, but just he was able to really kind of communicate this exhaustion through his eyes. And I think that was something that really helped inform the animators when they did keyframe that particular sequence to, you know, to be able to really capture that same feel.
Yeah, well, it's really, really interesting to see that. I think reference is obviously some of the most important thing in visual effects, and having someone that can help you with reference is always a key thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of everything. It's very hard to just sort of look at a shot and know what it needs. And so, you know, beyond what we had from Toby, we had a pretty nice library of chewing gorilla footage. We were pulling straight from the gorilla reference that we had. Okay. And in fact, one time we saw it in dailies, I was like, whoa, that's way too big. And then we went and looked at the reference like, oh, no, actually, we're a lot subtler than the real thing.
Right. Well, I think what's amazing about gorillas is whenever I see, you know, video footage of wild gorillas, is how slow they move. They move very slowly and very intentionally. Yep. And so,
no, that's very true. And I think one of the real struggles for us on the film was, you know, particularly for Scott, is how do you communicate the size and the power of this creature? Because at that size, it should really be moving very slowly. But at the same time, you have to balance that with, like, this is an action film, and, you know, he needs to fight all these creatures, and we don't want to be, you know, lingering on a shot for 15 seconds just waiting for him to lift his arm.
Right.
So I thought Scott did a really fantastic job finding that nice balance of selling scale without, you know, without necessarily like letting the shots drag out as far as what the action was.
Yeah, I think it was very well done. Now, what is one of your favorite shots on the movie?
I mean. Yeah, again, trying to avoid spoilers, I love the stuff in the final battle. There's a few shots there. I think you can see it in the trailer where Kong, like, hits the dweller with a tree that explodes, and then the skull crawler.
Yeah.
Falls into the water, and it just, you know, at all levels, the animation, the effects simulation, just all the water splashing around, some of the most fun shots I've ever, you know, had a chance to be involved with. And the entire team, you know, most of that sequence, when you see the shots and they have people in them, they're full, you know, they were shot in that location in Vietnam. But as soon as they don't have people in them and it's just the two creatures, they're largely all CG shots. And just everybody was working together incredibly well to kind of bring those to life. I loved those. And I guess probably my other favorite is that chewing squid shot. And a lot of it's because you know, Jordan sent us this reference from the movie Old Boy, which if you haven't had a chance to take that in, you can see it on YouTube, and it's pretty amazing where this actor eats a live octopus, and it's just tentacles wriggling and, you know, and all over his face. And that was really kind of the inspiration for that particular shot. And just knowing the kind of complex back and forth between action, the simulation. It was also one of our first shots where we actually ran a full sort of technology we use for our muscle simulation on the face, so that the lips would collide and squish on all the squid, and then all the water passes on top of it with the drips and the lighting and everything. That was a really fun shot. And actually, we do try and always have a lot of life in the eyes so that it, you know, it's a really engaging character and it kind of draws your attention there. But in that particular shot, we actually chose to leave it, you know, kind of dead-eyed, because he's just exhausted. And it was something that we kind of saw in the reference from Toby that we were able to kind of carry through to Kong's rendering in that shot.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I think it definitely worked. You know, he had just had this massive battle, obviously, and he was tired. and then yeah, the squid kind of interrupts his day.
Anytime you've got to wrestle your food like that, it takes a lot out of you.
Yeah. It was really cool. Well, great. We're kind of getting near the end, and I just want to sort of thank you again for being able to talk to us about this. Sure. Is there any? Can you tell us hints about some of the things you're working on next, or is that still very much under wraps at this point?
Yeah, no, nothing, nothing to share on that yet.
Okay,
we'll let you know as soon as we have it.
Okay, well, that'd be great to know about that.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, once again, I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun watching it and obviously talking to you about it right afterwards. So it was really fresh and excited that I could do that at this point.
Perfect timing. Yeah. Yeah. You should just do these right after you come out of the theater.
That sounds great. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate talking to you.
All right. Take care. Bye.